thing with the infinite, related to the infinite. Carl Jung says this is the question of our lives. From everlasting to everlasting, Waldemar Argau encourages us here. Infinity in your hand and eternity in an hour, so says William Blake. Those beautiful lines describe a state beyond the ordinary reality we inhabit. They're like telegrams from the land of mystery, calling us out of our everyday world and inviting us to practice being open to that which is beyond our current understanding. As Unitarian Universalists, we value reason in religion. We love the scientific process of testing and verifying knowledge, and we insist that our beliefs must make sense. And yet we also value awe and wonder. We value mystery with a capital M. It is one of the sources we claim our living religious tradition draws from, that direct experience of transcending mystery and wonder, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. That's the source we're honoring today, the one that would have us consider our relationship with infinity, that which is vast, limitless, expanding endlessly out beyond known space. Infinity can be tiny as well, smaller than small, as a line or an element can be divided over and over again into smaller and smaller increments, a point, a molecule, an atom, a particle. Have you experienced the infinite? Perhaps you, as a child, lay down in the grass on a clear, dark night and looked up at a sky awash with stars, stars beyond counting, seemingly far beyond comprehension. Or perhaps you've stood between two mirrors and saw on either side your reflection repeated infinite times, receding beyond clear sight in an endless corridor of frames. Or perhaps you've stood at the place where the land meets the sea and watched the infinite waves crash and pull back, ceaselessly moving, faithful to their own sacred rhythm. Who among us has not sensed the infinite? But the decisive question Jung raises, the telling question, he says, is about our relationship with the infinite. Now, he's not talking about how a human being might be related to the mathematical concept of infinity, though some of us may indeed be deeply interested in that. He's calling us toward the aesthetic and the spiritual, the work of poets and artists, philosophers and theologians who invoke infinity by its other name, eternity. Being human, we have the pain and the privilege of living with a paradox, the paradox that we're alive now, knowing that we will die. We know that we're finite, and yet our lives go on. We learn and we grow, we heal and we change in a manner that seems never ending. It makes us uneasy. Both science and religion help soothe that unease. They aid us with eternity's questions. Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Science takes the rational path, chipping away at life's mysteries and solving them into submission. Religion takes a different road. Christianity, with its central theme of resurrection, invites us to believe in an immortality of souls. The God of Islam is eternity itself, omnipotent and omnipresent. Hinduism and Buddhism give us a doorway to infinity through the eternal cycle of reincarnation, of karma shaping life and death and rebirth. And in Judaism, the four Hebrew letters of the Tetragrammaton, the letters which spell the name of God that is so holy it cannot be spoken, these four letters simply mean God was, God is, and God will be. With a serious brow, science asks how. With eyes turned skyward, religion asks why. So again, what's your relationship with the infinite? Have you ever thought about that? Again, think of lying on your back and gazing up at the night sky as a child. How did that feel? Perhaps you were humbled and felt yourself to be small and insignificant. Or perhaps you felt like you were falling or tumbling or soaring into unknown space, a feeling of exhilaration or terror. Or maybe you felt joy, a oneness with the universe, a magical sense of yourself as part of something beautiful and mysterious. Our relationship with the infinite can indeed be a joyful one. Certainly, the poets and philosophers felt it to be so after the 17th century when Galileo proved a sun-centered universe. And after Newton discovered the law of gravity in the 18th century, it was a time when scientific knowledge expanded rapidly and humanity rejoiced in the new and seemingly limitless horizons astronomers were uncovering. In those optimistic times, while some felt that the scientists were scraping the gold off of God's glories, many poems were written praising the revelations of science as proof of divine majesty. But the infinite, while it can be joyful, can also be frightening. Jewish theologian Martin Buber describes an experience he had when he was quite young. He wrote, "What stirs and terrifies man is not the infinity of space, it is the fact that by the impression of infinity, any concept of space, a finite one no less than an infinite, becomes uncanny." He continues, "When I was but 14 years of age, I myself experienced this in a way which deeply influenced my whole life. A necessity I could not understand swept over me. I had to try again and again to imagine an edge of space, or to imagine its edgelessness, to imagine time with a beginning or an end, or time without beginning or end. And both were equally impossible, equally hopeless. Yet there seemed to be only the choice between one or the other absurdity. Under an irresistible compulsion, I reeled from one to the other, at times so closely threatened with the danger of madness, I seriously thought to avoid it by suicide." No matter where we are on the spectrum between the joyful experience of infinity and the pain of its ultimate unknowability, Carl Jung would invite us to consider our relationship with the infinite and how it shapes the way we live. What exactly is meant by this? On the one hand, it's not explainable. It has to be felt and experienced. If I ask you to tell me a story of how you are related to the infinite, I wonder what you would say. I have a daughter who is 13 now, but some years ago, when she was about 5 or 6, I started teaching her how to sew. And one day, as we were sitting at the dining room table, plying our needles and thread together on a simple project, she complimented me on my sewing and she thanked me for teaching her. And I said, "Well, Grace, I know how to sew like this because my mother taught me just as I am teaching you." And my daughter replied, "I bet her mama taught her too, right?" And I said, "Yeah, no doubt that was true because I knew my grandmother had been an accomplished seamstress." But Grace went on, fascinated. She said, "And I bet your grandma's mother taught her, and her mother taught her, and her mother taught her, all the way back to the very beginning." We paused then and we looked at each other, suddenly knowing ourselves as part of a great chain of needle women, stitching together the fabric of family and creativity and necessity across time, all the way back to the very beginning. It was an experience of infinity. So perhaps when you consider your relationship with the infinite, you might think of the concept that within each one of us, there is an inner self which responds to the great soul of the whole. That was one of the ways of thinking that our Unitarian Transcendentalist ancestors like Ralph Waldo Emerson understood as encompassing the natural world and yet contained within that world, a sense of infinity. We are part of the soul of the whole. Or perhaps the infinite casts your thinking to the story of quantum physics, to string theory or the older particle and wave theories, and the idea that we're all just energy in motion, that we're all made up of the same stuff. Our bodies, the planet, the wood of this pulpit, the polyester fibers of the carpeting, the light and energy of the chalice flame, all one substance, one piece, an infinity of continuity. But again, it's not just the infinite. The deeper question is how our relationship with it shapes our lives, shapes our way of being. So here's a story that might help us with that. One day, God decided to become visible to two people, a king and a peasant. An angel was sent to inform each of those people about this blessed event that was about to happen. And the angel went to the king and said, "O king, God will be revealed to you in whatever manner you wish. In what form would you like God to appear? Seated on his high throne and surrounded by awestruck subjects, the king proclaimed, 'How else would we wish to see God save in majesty of power? Of course you must show God to us in the full glory of power.'" Well, the king's wish was granted. God appeared as a bolt of lightning, which instantly pulverized the king and his court. Nothing remained, not even a cinder. The angel then went to the peasant and said, "God will be revealed to you in whatever manner you desire. How do you wish to see God?" Well, the peasant was baffled. He stood and he scratched his head for a while and thought about it. And finally he said, "I am not worthy to see God face to face. But if God wishes to be revealed to me, how can I refuse? Let me see God in the things that I'm familiar with. Let me see God in the earth that I plow, in the food that I eat. Let me see God in the presence of the faces of my family and my neighbors. And if God's willing, perhaps even in the reflection of my own face." God, of course, granted the peasant's wish, and the peasant lived a long and happy life. So what does this story tell us? One interpretation might be that each of these two characters simply asked to see God in a way that was familiar to him. The king was powerful, the peasant was humble. But I think it's actually a cautionary tale, not about God, which is, after all, just a symbol, but about the infinite. It reminds us that when we approach the infinite from a place of arrogance, when we assume we can tame it and fully understand it, no relationship with it is possible, and our human potential will be unrealized, like the king, will be annihilated by our own certainty. But recognizing that we're part of something larger, something present, but whose beginning and end we cannot see, gives us power to keep growing. Like the peasant, we may begin to see infinity all around us, embracing us. We might begin to be able to dance with it. The power of the infinite is in our relationship with it. This is why scientists triumph when their theories are proven empirically, while rejoicing at the same time that mystery still waits for them just over the next hill. When we are humble and respectful, the infinite calls to us. It gets into relationship with us and invites us to create the next theory, the next work of art. It lures forth from us our next triumph. So if we experience the infinite as the flow of generations that came before us, pass through us, and continue on after we are gone, will we live our lives committed to learning our ancestors' wisdom and instilling it in our children? If we experience the infinite as the oneness of everything, in the way our transcendentalist ancestors did, will we change how we live to respect more fully the interdependent web of life, that web that we are just a small part of? Here's another little story. This one comes from UU minister Walter Royal Jones, and it's about a street evangelist. So one day, the street evangelist took up her place at a busy intersection. And as she stood there, she was almost completely hidden between the panels of a sandwich sign that she was wearing that proclaimed on the front in huge letters, "The Answer." The rest of the sign was blank except for some words at the bottom in very small print that said, "Please see the other side." People who stopped to read what was on the front of her almost always went to the other side and looked behind her, where to their amazement, they found the identical announcement in huge letters, "The Answer," again with "Please see the other side" written at the bottom. Perplexed, some people would race from front to back and then front and round again while the evangelist stood quietly. Others shrugged their shoulders and left, thinking, "Crazy, crazy." Some would snicker and left laughing, thinking the evangelist was making a joke and being a clown. Still others, sensing an insult to their settled convictions that there truly is an answer, left scowling. At length, a wise person came by, considered the evangelist from the front and then from the back, and then stood a while pondering. Finally, the person spoke. "Oh, yes," they said quietly. "We want the answer, yet we must always be willing to see another side." And the evangelist smiled. You know, we live in a world where we're compelled to find answers for every question, reasons for everything that happens to us, and where we tend to classify and compartmentalize every problem and every aspiration, both our own and those of other people. In a world like that, remaining open to mystery provides that view from the other side. It balances our heads with our hearts, our minds with our spirits, and rounds out our understanding of the complexity of reality. We build our relationship with the infinite, with the stuff of our finite lives. We build it with our questions, our awe, and our wonder. We dance to it with the rhythm of both our joy and our fear. We build our relationship with the infinite by remaining open to mystery, as well as by the knowledge that we gain by finding answers. And indeed, our knowledge should compel us to change how we live so that our questions actually go to the next level. That's the opportunity that dancing with the infinite gives us a chance to climb to the summit of the mountain, to let our hearts soar to heights our heads will never know. So I want to invite you to practice being open to mystery. And here's how to do it. First, we have to give up the idea that we can always get it. We have to give up the notion that everything has to make sense. We have to practice living with the paradox. Second, I would invite you to eschew answers and instead listen for stories. And then I would say, remember to be suspicious of ologies. Those technologies that try to explain everything, etymology, technology, biology, psychology, theology. Because there are some things in life, like evil, injustice, and suffering, that call for tears, not explanations. They call for our broken hearts to weep and to act with compassion, not to talk about it. And when you come to the end of your understanding someplace, don't fake it. Just say, "I don't know." So let's practice that. I don't know. Sometimes we Unitarian Universalists are so smart. We think we always have to know. But we don't. To be human, to be spiritual, to grow, means having a humble and profound respect for the edge where known and unknown meet. When we practice being open to mystery, We stand quietly and patiently in the creative place between impossible question and improbable answer, and from that holy and liminal place, wisdom will rise. To see the world in a grain of sand, and to know heaven in a wildflower, to experience with open hearts the span from everlasting to everlasting, to dance with mystery, and to know ourselves related to the infinite. That's the quest. I invite you to embrace this holy human quest. Shalom, blessed be, and amen. And let us once again sing.